Welcome to Double D's Definitive DVD Podcast.
Oh yeah.
My name is David Bjerre and I'm joined by...
Dennis Rosenfeld.
Exactly. Usually this is a Danish podcast, but today we have decided to record an introduction in English because we have a treat that we feel international listeners might enjoy.
Yeah.
The treat in question is an exclusive interview with production designer Joe Alves.
You like saying that exclusive?
Exclusive.
Huh?
That's yeah, you great like that sound.
Word. Exclusive. Joe Alves. He's a big production designer. He worked on Jaws, Close Encounters.
Yeah, he was big in his day.
Lots of what's it called? New York. Escape from New York.
Escape from New York. Yeah.
Great production designer. So how did this interview come to be?
How come we're so cool?
Yeah, that's the question.
Yeah, exactly.
But I didn't want to say it like that. I tone it down a bit and just say, how did this interview?
Just say it.
How come we're so cool?
Well, the thing is, Joe was in Copenhagen recently, a couple of weeks ago, in the end of April 2008. And he did a lecture for 2 days where he talked about a lot of his work. Jaws, Close Encounters, like you mentioned. After the lecture, I approached him, and I got his email, and we got an interview and permission to do an interview with him. And the idea was that we would do an interview about all the other projects he's done, you know, Drop Zone and Fire Down Below, and he directed Jaws 3.
Oh yeah,
yeah. So that's our subject for today: Joe's other works.
Cool.
So, of course, we're going to talk a lot about his films, and we're going to talk about specific scenes and some visual stuff.
Yeah.
So to help us along, we have a web page that you can log on to.
You made a web page,
exactly,
especially for this occasion.
Occasion.
I like that. It's called. Now I'm going to rattle off a long address.
Go on.
It's called davidbjerre.dk/podcast/Joe, and that's davidbjerre.dk/podcast/Joe, Joe.
Yeah, exactly. It's rather simple. davidbjerre.dk/podcast/Joe.
Yeah,
that's great. So we're gonna have a lot of, but he's gonna mention some things in passing and some scenes that he shot and various things. And we're gonna have screenshots.
Yeah,
of those scenes to correspond with the time code in the podcast, so you can check it out. Yeah, so that's it.
That's cool.
That's it, I guess.
Yeah.
So without further ado, let's go to the interview with Joe Alves. So Joe, thanks a lot for talking to us today. We had a great time when you were in Copenhagen. So it was really interesting to listen to you talk about your work.
It was fun.
It was fun. That's good.
Yeah, I enjoyed it immensely.
But let's talk about the role of the production designer. What exactly does a production designer do, in your words?
Well, you know, a production designer does as much as his relationship with the producer and director allows. And what I mean is the confidence that they have in you. A producer... friend of mine who also was a production manager on Sugarland Express and on Jaws and stuff, and he once said, you know, I said, but I appreciate you always try to hire me on a picture, and he said, Joe, when I hire you, then I don't have to worry about that department, you know. I could feel very comfortable. So this is the point. When you have that kind of comfort level, and I had that relationship with Spielberg and with John Carpenter and a few directors, so that it's sort of, okay, they allow you to go out and make certain judgments, pre-judgments. So let's say my responsibility is I read the script and I try to visualize the movie, the locations, the sets, and special props and things like that. And I make a lot of notes and I break everything down. And I have a discussion with the director and see if we're eye to eye on this. And quite often, you know, they'll say, well, go out and scout, break some things down, let me see what you have in mind. So that's one of my first responsibilities, is to go out. Now today, they have a lot of location scouts in the United States, and they do an awful lot of that preliminary work. But in the early years, as I explain on Jaws and Close Encounters. I did a lot of that scouting by myself.
It seemed like you almost covered more than just the production design department. You covered the location department as well sometimes.
Well, but that basically, the location department is the production. I mean, a location guy, you're asking him to be the visual eyes of the movie, of finding locations. And they quite often don't have the art background, you know. Sometimes they come from, you know, more of a business thing, and they end up more in the production department than they do in an art department. And so it's great. Let me tell you, here's how I think they work very well. For example, let's say Fire Down Below had a very good location guy. So we weren't sure if we were going to shoot it in West Virginia or Kentucky, but some mining community, coal mining community.
There was a specific call for that in the story, right?
Yeah, it was a very specific thing in the script, that it was a small town, coal mining town, and there was some corruption going on with the depositing unclean or toxic waste into the and actually this is a true story. They actually found hundreds of toxic barrels of stuff in a ravine. So that was the story. So I had to find, you know, a little town that was, it had a nice look to it. So he sort of roughed out a lot of areas, knowing the area, talking to people. And then I met with him, and he eliminated a lot of places. But we still spent a couple weeks, you know, looking until I got it down to maybe 10 key locations that I could bring the director and suggest what was good for certain areas and narrow it down. Or maybe I'd narrow it down even to less. So then you narrow it down, and then when it gets close to the director likes this one or that one, then you get more specific into it. They go away, you spend time with the location guy. He starts talking to merchants and city officials and see if we're going to have any problems. Yeah, if the look is fairly comfortable to the director and to myself, and one place has certain advantages for other locations and for, let's say, the community cooperation and building facilities and things like that,
right,
then you start to make those choices. So it's very important. You know, a location guy can't really understand, okay, this exterior looks great, but I need warehouses to build sets, and I need access to this. So then I bring in my construction foreman, and once we're fairly comfortable to where we're going to be, then he starts looking around for a facility as a mill to start building sets.
Right.
Because quite often we need to build sets on location. So that's really part of the art department, is location scouting, and you work very closely with the location guy. As I said, on Jaws and Close Encounters, I didn't have a location guy on Jaws.
You were one man show.
Yeah, pretty much. And then on Close Encounters later, we got a production manager and we got a location guy. And then he really starts nailing down the permits, talking to the business people. So his job really is more of a business tied to the production department than he is to the art department as far as the visual concept. I mean, I'll give you an example. I picked up the script of a movie called Drop Zone. So I read the script, and I talked to John Badham, and we went to a drop zone out in Arizona someplace. And it was very interesting, and we had a very fine technical advisor who had choreographed the incredible aerial drop for the Barcelona World Olympics, where they had a big ring. They made a ring of like 100, skydivers. And anyway, he was very helpful. But anyway, I said to John, I said, you know, you're going to shoot so much from the air, and we're really looking down on some pretty unattractive terrain. Just sort of, you know, brown kind of desert terrain. He said, well, that's where most of the drop zones are. I said, yeah, but it doesn't have to be. And he said, well, okay, what do you have in mind? I said, well, how about something like the Florida Keys, where we're looking down at the incredible, Keys with the deep blue ocean and then the beautiful coral, not coral, but the sort of aqua as it gets closer to the various little islands.
Right.
And he said, well, that sounds really interesting. And the guy that was the key advisor to us, he said, well, that's interesting because I have an apartment in Key Largo. And we do jump, from the plane, and then we jump over to the island. But there's no drop zone there. So I said, well, let's go look. So we found a deserted RV park. A recreational park that was just a big area,
right?
And nobody was doing anything with it. So after much negotiations with the city or the county or whatever, they allowed us to actually. I ended up building some hangars and a runway, and I made a drop zone there.
So just to be clear, the entire landing field of that small training area they have, where they have that school, that
yes.
You built that?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I built that.
I thought that was a real thing.
No, that was a set. And also, that wonderful, I built this sort of, where she had her school, which was up on stilts.
Right, and there's this great view outside the window, right?
All shutters around it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I built that, and Roy Wagner was the cameraman.
Right.
Very, very nice guy. And this is the first time in my life, David, I've ever had a crew get off the bus, look at the set, and they started to applaud. I mean, it was Roy that
really?
Was, Yeah, they started to applaud the set, and I was really... that was very touching.
But it looks great. It looks great in the film.
Well, and the reason I had to raise it because there's these mangroves and you can't see any water unless you get up.
Right.
So I had everything up on stilts. So in any case, there's an example of taking a script that could have been very visually uninteresting,
Right.
If you followed the dictates of the script and put it in a normal drop zone. But having a director that had confidence in me, I had done a lot of television with John. We did a number of television movies together and television shows.
Right.
So he said, well, let Joe go, see what he can come up with. So actually, they ended up making hats and T-shirts calling it Alvesville.
Oh, that's great.
Yes, I still have some...
That's great.
Little baseball caps where it says Alvesville. But anyway, I mention that because that's what a production designer does. He reads the script and he interprets the visual, and it may be different than the writer's concept or the director's concept. And if they have confidence in you, sometimes they'll let you go.
Right.
Sometimes the director's ego is too big and he just doesn't want that much input, So when I say what is his job is her job is to read the script, break it down, visualize the all aspects. And in the case of the Jaws, the shark was a huge moving prop. So I got very, very involved in special effects.
Right.
And so that's, it depends on the film.
It doesn't sound like you're doing too much artwork and drawing because you before that part of the process, you seem to start by looking at the environment, sort of.
Yeah, you do, but you also have certain things in the back of your mind. Like, for an example, in Fire Down Below, when I started looking for locations, and I think I explained how we built everything on a hilltop, I started making little sketches of that church right away. And it ended up just on a little notepad, And it came out fairly close to some of my early sketches. And then I would give that to my set designer or art directors, and then they would develop it, in proportions and something structural that they could build. I didn't get into, you don't really have a lot of time. On Jaws, I did, because I drew before I was on the movie, those concept sketches. And then when everybody was out, to see, or actually before, once I had the sets built, I started doing the storyboards.
Right.
But but generally, you know, you're running around doing locations, scouting things. So you make quick sketches, and then you turn it over to an illustrator like George Jensen, who I had on a number of movies, and then the set designers, and then you let them detail. You draw what you have to get everything going, but you spend an awful lot of time on the set with the director, with the producer, talking about the various problems, you know.
But I guess the process is also different depending on what kind of film it is. For example, if you did a science fiction movie, you wouldn't be able to just go out and pick a location that easily.
No, you're right. You see, when you're doing something like science fiction and then you need a futuristic-looking sets, then you really need film commissions and location scouts. And you say, you know, I need an ultra, ultra, contemporary-looking building. And so you start getting input, and you put the word out, and location guy will put the word out, and he starts contacting all these film commissions. And then you start getting photographs and stuff from Texas or Montana or wherever, or it could be in Europe.
Was that your process on Free Jack, for example?
Well, on Free Jack, yeah, on Free Jack we had... We knew we had certain parts of New York, so that was going to be, you know, and it wasn't that far in the future. We were doing it in 1990, and it was supposed to be 2018. So you could use a lot of stuff. So Atlanta had some really nice contemporary buildings. When you're dealing with stuff like that, where you need contemporary buildings or a certain look, then you have feelers out all over the place. Now, on Escape from New York, I needed a bridge that we could build a wall at the end. So it had to be a substantial bridge that wasn't in use. So we had to get feelers out all over the place.
That can't be easy to find, can it?
But you contact, you know, and this is the thing, in more recent years, the film commissions are very, very active, because to bring a company in to a city, they make a lot of money. Merchants make a lot of money.
Obviously, yeah.
Yeah. So, but when we were doing Jaws, that wasn't that popular. Massachusetts didn't have a film commission. When we did Sugarland Express, Texas did have a film commission, and Texas was very, very comfortable to shoot in. Massachusetts wasn't. And some of the states that, you know, years ago that didn't have film commissions, that, you know, they just thought that you were going to go into, the city and rip everybody off and rape their daughters and, you know, do all that stuff. And so the film commissions explained to these people, no, you don't understand. The hotels are going to be full. The restaurants are going to be full of people. You're going to make so much money. So they got the idea, this is a good thing.
All right.
So anyway, that's where a production designer then has these options, has to work closely with film commissions. Then you go to a city like Atlanta, and then you start saying, okay, we got this, we got that. We can't shoot everything here, but, boy, we could have our base here, you know.
So you do a little mix and match of the different cities, yeah, and different locations.
But when we were doing Drop Zone, my idea was to do all the stuff in Florida, all the exteriors, and then move to Atlanta and build the sets in Atlanta, because I had such an incredibly good crew and everything, and in Atlanta, and we were all set to do that. I had warehouses and I had that I were going to build sets in, and then the studio executives at Paramount decided, no, we want you back home. And the reason is because they get a percentage of the picture to run the studio. So then it becomes a political thing. Oh. So the sets end up costing a considerable amount, you know, amount more.
That's just silly.
But the money went into the the studio.
Right.
And they got their whatever 30% surcharge by having it on the studio lot. And I really hated it because you lose control.
Yeah.
In other words, if I'm on location and I have an elevator and my production or construction guy builds the elevator, but we need the special effects department to rig it to go up and down. And then I go to the effects guy and say, you know, rig it. So he rigs it immediately. On a studio, then you have to go to the effects department head.
Oh.
And then he determines when he wants to do it.
Right. So it's politics again.
Yeah, so it's politics again. And you say, but no, I need it now. He says, well, yeah, but we have these other movies that are priority. Well, when you're on location, you are the priority.
Right.
So I've always enjoyed making movies away from major studios.
Yeah.
I've always enjoyed just setting up my warehouse with my construction crew, my art department, and working closely with the effects department, prop makers and stuff. And that way, you're a little entity unto yourself. In a major studio, you're just part of a number of many movies. You know, so that was the old studio system.
So is that a factor in your decision to do a project where you can, if you can sense that this is going to be one of those studio control things, or you will get more freedom? Is that a factor in you saying yes to a project?
That would be definitely a factor. You know, when I was in a position, you know, Hollywood is a funny thing. If you're fortunate to make it to the A-list, and that's not necessarily talent, but being lucky that you had a movie that made a lot of money,
right?
You know, and suddenly you're on the A-list, and people say, oh, I mean, and there's some people that aren't so talented, but they luck out, and the movie becomes successful, and so now they're doing movies that are way over their head. I mean, I know production designers that can't draw, they can't draft, they can barely, and they're doing huge movies. Unbelievable. And so that movie, you know, it could be Die Hard, you know, and then Die Hard 2, and then something else. I can't even remember who did the production, but that happens a lot.
Yeah.
And suddenly these guys are doing these big movies, and you talk to their art director or set designer and say, well, the guy can't even read plans, you know, but he's got this reputation now, and the directors want him, and he does good politics. So anyway, you know, that's what happened. So, but when you're on the A-list, then you can dictate, do I want to do this movie because it's here or away? But if your movies aren't, you know, stop being successful, then you don't last on the A-list for, you know, then you drop to the B-list and things like that. So, and that's true with directors and actors and everything. I mean, there's not much imagination in Hollywood. What Richard Dreyfuss used to say this. He said, you start out, they say, like, who's Richard Dreyfuss? You know, and oh, he's a young guy. Okay. then you do Jaws, Close Encounters,
right.
Or Goodbye Girl. You know, he won the Academy.
Yeah, yeah.
Then they say, get me Richard Dreyfuss, you know. He's other. Get me a Richard Dreyfuss type, you know? And then after, you know, things aren't so successful, then they say, who's Richard Dreyfuss?
That's funny.
And that's sort of the way that goes, you know? It's like...
Does that apply to production design as well?
I think so. Yeah, you know...
You're only as hot as your latest film.
Yeah, yeah. If you make too many movies that aren't successful, and that goes for a production designer or a cameraman, they sort of forget you. They want the next hot person, you know. So, and then the market has opened up a lot, you know. When we first started shooting Fire Down Below, which was a movie about a Kentucky coal mine.
Right.
And they hired a German director and a Chinese cameraman.
Yes.
And there's nothing wrong with that, because the cameraman couldn't speak English, and you're wondering, why would you do that? you know. I mean, there's plenty of good cameramen.
That is a bit strange. And they both got fired, didn't they?
Yeah. One quit and the other one got fired.
Yeah.
But that's my point. I think it's fun working with people, you know, all over the world, but it does make it very, very competitive. You know, I mean, today there's a couple hot Mexican directors. If you look at the Academy Awards this year, there wasn't one American that won that Best Acting, you know. And we have a very good friend, Helen Mirren, who won the Academy Award last year, and just about every award. And Helen's, you know, English, and her husband's Taylor Hackford, and my wife used to be his assistant. And,
oh, right.
Yeah, and you know, that's very good, but it's just much more competitive.
But it sometimes seems like it's more fun to do the small projects where you can go under the radar.
Yeah, yeah, I know. I think so.
I mean, for example, Escape from New York was a very small film for its time, wasn't it?
Very, very small film, and it had some good people involved. Dean Cundey is a very fine cameraman. And it was one of the most fun, though, movies that I worked on. And it was, because it was independent, and so there's no real studio dictates, you know.
All right.
Where Free Jack was terrible. You know, Ron Shusett was a director, I mean, was a writer,
right.
And he wrote some successful movies.
He wrote Alien, right? Didn't
yeah,
he?
And he wrote an Arnold thing.
There's Total Recall, right?
Total Recall, yeah. And anyway, I liked Ron. So Ron, he started out writing the thing. Then they hire Jeff Murphy, a New Zealand director. And then there's Jim Robinson, who was, you know, industrious. He had some kind of industry. I can't remember what, but he was a car nut. And but he did develop Morgan Creek, and he didn't really know anything about making movies, but he could dictate stuff. And then you had the studio was very involved. So then they get rid of Ron. They bring somebody in. It was just constant interference. And then they had Linda Ferrantino on. They shot 7-8 days with her, and then they decided to fire her and bring in Rene Russo. And I don't think she was right at all with Emilio.
She was too old compared to him, if you ask me.
Yeah, and she, her really sweet lady, I got to tell you.
Oh, absolutely. Very, very, yeah, probably. Yeah.
But she didn't look right with him. You know, it's a proportion, I think, you know. She did look older. Her head's bigger than his. I don't know. It's just it didn't look comfortable.
There's a great sequence in the film where they walk down a motorway, I think, or something, and
yeah.
She's a head taller than him. And
yeah.
Then they cut into the close up, and suddenly he's half a head taller than she is.
Oh, I know.
Mysteriously,
it was such a mess. It was, you know. And we worked so hard, and I use that as an example how you could work so hard and on the movies that aren't successful, you know.
You said that. You said the bad films require just as much work as the good ones.
They do.
Yeah.
You know, because who knows, you know. You start out and you could have good people. And anyway, but it's I use it because there's some interesting visuals. And I was particularly, for an art department, I like to talk about the story of doing a waterfront, warehouse waterfront area where you have no water and you make the water instead of the warehouse, you know.
Right, that was a great shot, and you can't tell that there was no water.
But you see what I mean, David? That's a production designer. That's what I would try to teach these young people.
Right.
Is don't close your mind off. Don't say, but we need a waterfront, so we have to go to the water. No, what you need, it's just a warehouse. You need a loading dock. And so all you have to do is make sure the director doesn't want to do a reverse.
Right.
Yeah, if he did a reverse, you'd be dead.
That's exactly.
Yeah.
You mentioned, I think it was in an interview, that there were only a couple of directors that you would want to work like that for, you know, build the sets to what they need exactly. It was John Carpenter and Alfred Hitchcock, I think you mentioned.
You know, and Hitchcock was from another generation, and that was major studio stuff. And I was like a young guy, assistant art director. But I did have some contact with him, and he called me in the office one time, and the production designer was gone and this and that, and then he told me what he wanted, and he was very, very specific. He drew out this set. He said to me, you know, Joe, he says, I'm going to have Mr. Newman run down these stairs.
Just to clarify, it's torn curtain we're talking about, right?
Yeah, torn curtain. Yeah. And he says that Mr. Newman's going to run down the stairs over here, and Mr. Whitlock, Albert Whitlock, is going to make a mat here, and I'd like you to build this staircase, and you just have to build this much of it because we'll do this in the mat. And the same thing, he says, well, we had a big hotel lobby, and he said, I'm going to bring Mr. Newman from the elevator to the registration desk and then out here, so we won't need a reverse. So don't build that. So that's filmmaking the way it should be.
Right.
You don't. Why build something you're not going to shoot?
No.
Why waste the money?
And they do that so often in Hollywood. You see these elaborate sets, and you say, "Well, I didn't see that in the film. Why did they build it?"
I can show you so much. Geronimo. I kept pointing that out.
Yeah. I mean, your stories on Geronimo made me cry almost.
Well, here you have Gene Hackman. You have the cavalry, and what we did is we had these reenactors
right.
that actually reenact the cavalry, the Civil War. They do battles of Gettysburg and all this stuff. They reenact, so they come equipped with all their stuff. So you have 250 reenacting guys. You have Gene Hackman, and he's got this huge fort, and you'd see Geronimo would want to look at this and say, this is what I'm coming to. Do you know what I mean? I would think just psychologically you'd want to shoot it, if not for the visual.
Absolutely, yeah.
And yet he didn't. And
that was Walter Hill, right?
Yeah, and Walter did that a number of times. And I think it was so cerebral. He was so into rewriting and the words and the words and the words. And quite often in Westerns, it's not so much about words. You know, and God, you know, John Ford used to, I mean, it's John Wayne walking up to the thing, and you see this in the background, and you get the power of the thing, you know, without a whole bunch of dialogue.
Right, yeah.
And I think that was the demise of Geronimo. It never really worked, you know.
But you said that in when you were in Copenhagen, you said you liked Walter Hill. It wasn't because you had a problem with him.
But, oh, no, he's nice.
Yeah, but he was difficult to work for, wasn't he?
Yeah. He was difficult. I built sets, and then it was too far to drive, and so then I rebuilt the sets, and then I researched the thing, but then he didn't want where it was researched. He wanted, you know, it's still difficult, you know. Some directors are that way. They're not that visual.
Is that important to you, the director collaboration? I mean, do you decide what films you want to do based on that, and the reputation of the director?
Oh yeah, I think that's important.
Because he is your closest collaborator, isn't he? I mean,
oh, absolutely. You know, it was interesting when I directed. You know, somebody told me good advice. Said, stay out of the art department. You know, you're going to have enough trouble. You know, develop your relationship with the actors, work with the writer,
right?
Stay out of the art department, find a good art director, production designer, and let him have give him confidence to do, you know. And that was good advice.
Well, let's talk about a little bit about your directing career then, because that's really interesting. I mean, how did you get into that in the first place?
The first thing I ever directed, when I was doing Night Gallery, that was a television show. It was Rod Serling's, update of Twilight Zone.
Right. Yeah.
Twilight Zone was a big black and white series that had da 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 da. You know,
yeah.
that sound, you know, the Twilight Zone, which sounds a little bit like Close Encounters. But anyway, so then Night Gallery was a series with a lot of young directors. Spielberg, John Badham, Janosch Schwartz, and because we had a lot of directors, I really had to sort of, they didn't have much prep time, so I really had to sort of like pre-direct a lot of stuff, you know, as far as the sets and where the actors are going to move here and there. So when they came in, they had 1 or 2 days prep. I pretty much laid it out. So you start to think more as a director, you know.
Right. So you got a taste for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then on Jaws, Stephen left me with a number of things to direct. I directed some of the boat sinking. I directed the kid on the raft with the shark taking the kid on the raft with a bunch of kids in the foreground.
Right.
So I did about, I guess, 3 or 4 different pickup stuff there. And that was a pretty big shot with the shark and the kids and all that stuff.
But that was sort of uncredited, right?
Oh, yeah. There's no credit. In fact, I got busted by the Directors Guild because I wasn't in the guild. And and here my assistant director, which I've known for years and years, he's turned me in because I was doing this stuff. And Bruna Fields, who was the editor, she was doing some pickup shots, some inserts and stuff.
Right.
But the shot with all the kids and the shark and the little boy in the raft, that was a big deal. Okay, so then after that came Jaws 2. And I ended up directing 100 days, which is a lot.
100 days?
100 days.
That's, oh my God, that's 2 feature films almost.
Oh, easily. Some feature films are, Sugarland was only 36 days, so it's like, yeah, almost 3 small films.
Do you recall how many shooting days there were in total on that film?
Yeah, 148.
Wow.
Because I had the call sheets, So I started directing a lot because they fired the first director, and I was responsible bringing in Janosch Schwartz on that. And they talked about Verna Fields and myself directing Jaws 2, but the Directors Guild wouldn't let us do that. They don't let you transfer from if a director gets fired from one department to the other. There's reasons for that, because people would fire and let the editor direct it, you know. So
Right. Anyway,
I brought in Janot because I thought on Night Gallery he was the best director that we had. And as it turned out, it was very, very difficult.
So it was your responsibility to bring a new director in, or you did that?
Well, I was also a producer.
Oh, yeah, you were associate producer on it, right?
Yeah, and the associate producers is sort of a loose credit today, but with Zanuck and Brown, they never had associates. They were very, very strong, big producers. And so to get me to do Jaws 2 instead of the Spielberg's movie...
1941, right?
And I probably would have done 41, but Spielberg didn't have it ready. And after they fired the first director, they asked me to go to Steven and see if he would do Jaws 2. And we met, he said he would, but he wanted $1 million, and they thought that was out of the question. And
he probably didn't want to do it, right?
He probably didn't want to
do
it. Not really. In fact, he didn't want Jaws 2 to be made.
I can understand that, but he didn't have any rights over the first film.
He had nothing. He was a hired gun. In fact, he had no percentage until they gave him something afterwards. They gave him a little tidbit here and there, and then it made so much money, he probably made a couple million bucks off of it. But no, he was just a hired kid, you know, young guy. And so then his career after Jaws just went crazy. But we were already behind right away because we fired one guy. We wanted to get the release for the next summer. So, and I had found the location when I was doing Close Encounters, I found a location that I thought would be better to shoot a Jaws 2 if they ever made a Jaws 2. And that's where I showed you the lighthouse that we built to make it look more New England and stuff.
Right, with the beautiful white sand and everything.
Yeah, yeah. And anyway, so right away we started falling behind, so I started doing pickup shots. In fact, I did some in Martha's Vineyard. Then I started anything that the second unit got in... I mean, the first unit got bogged down. Like the whole sequence with the helicopter and the shark eating the helicopter,
right.
You know, knocking the helicopter down, if you remember the movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
I did that sequence.
Ooh.
I did a lot of sequences. And so, as I said, I ended up directing 100 Days. So when I finished with Jaws 2, I came back to the States, and someone approached me about directing a movie called The Weathermen, and it was about a sci-fi movie about these satellites and how they controlled the weather and all this stuff. And it was I had a lot of press on it. I was in the paper. I was going to direct it, and Clint Eastwood was going to be in it. It was all just fantasy, you know.
That would have been great.
Yeah, but it didn't happen. But and so then Arthur Penn and Chet Panichesky, they asked me to do Altered States, and so then I got back into doing that, but then they fired Arthur. And so then I was going to do this big Formula One movie. It was a pretty good script, and I met with James Brolin, and he was going to be one of the actors, and I scouted the locations all over Europe. It was great, and I had a lot of, I used to race Formula cars, so I was very familiar with the subject.
You're a versatile guy.
Well, it was something I enjoyed doing, and that's how I met Paul Newman, and I worked on Winning with Paul after Torn Curtain. And got him interested in racing, and you know, goes on and on. But anyway, so that was going to be a great thing. I talked to the Williams people who make a Formula One car about making a car for us, a mock-up. So if you ever saw the movie Grand Prix,
yeah,
with James, you know, anyway, Frankenheimer movie. It was going to be a big movie about Formula One Grand Prix and superstar models, you know. So it was going to be the fashion world and Formula One. So it was going to be really sort of a high-level, glitzy-looking movie.
Beautiful girls and beautiful cars.
Exactly.
Can't go wrong.
Yeah, and what it turned out to be was actually a father and son racing against each other. The old guy was a champion, and his son was coming up, and they started racing together. Well, that happened in this country. Michael Andretti started racing against his father, Mario Andretti, who was a Formula One world champion.
Right.
And I was at a race years later where it was on Father's Day, and they were racing, and Mario beat his son by 3 inches in the race after a two-hour race. Anyway, so I got back, and Filmways was a company, Bill Gilmore was one of the executives, they sold the company, and that went the other way, so that never happened. So then I did Escape from New York. Then I started pursuing a lot of different projects. And I had some really good scripts.
You mentioned one called Adventure One.
Adventure One, let me tell you about that. That happened after Jaws 3 and after Everybody's All-American. I had Adventure One, and that was brought to me by my agent and this young entrepreneur guy. And we got this young, I didn't like the script, but we went to Cannes with it to promote it. And we made this huge poster. Tom McCall, who did the posters for Space Odyssey, 2001, we got him to make this beautiful poster, 4-foot poster, in front of the Majestic Hotel, and that was at Cannes in 1989, and it was announcing my directing this big science fighter. And we had a big yacht, we had all this stuff, and we got back, and I got this script. It was on a promotional thing. In fact, there was so much promotion, and I went back to Germany, and I became a judge on this world contest. There was another promotional thing. So,
oh my God!
It looked real good. You know, David, it looked like it was going to happen. And we got this young writer, David Kemp, who hadn't really done anything.
Oh my God, he's famous now.
He's famous, yeah. And he rewrote it.
You mentioned Nicole Kidman, and
I was very interested in Nicole Kidman. I had seen her first movie, her only movie. And I liked her, and we were trying to make contact with that. And I worked on it about 7 months, did a lot of artwork, and then the money fell out.
It's such a shame. So much work.
Oh, yeah. I just go on about the movies that don't happen, you know?
Yeah.
I worked on a number of movies. I worked on a movie called The Ninja for Zanuck and Brown for 10 months, scattered all over Japan. I built the sets. The director, Irvin Kershner, was having trouble casting it. And then Marvin Davis bought Fox Studios and canceled all the projects that weren't cast or something. Anyway, so what happened was Adventure One, it just dissolved. Guy walked in one day and said the money was gone. He had financing with Japan, and that fell out. My production manager went on to be head of production at Amblin, Jerry Mullen. And David Kemp went on to write Jurassic Park. And I went out looking for a job. And right. So then, from there, now I got married, started having kids. I have to resurrect my career as a production designer because I had to go to work, right?
Right, right.
And that became difficult because now I've turned down a lot of movies. I turned down Patriot Games. I turned down other stuff because I just wanted to direct, you know.
We had a similar problem with a Danish guy you may know called Michael Salomon, who was a really big cinematographer who wanted to direct, and he turned down some very big projects.
Yeah.
And he's directing TV now. He's doing very good, but it took him 15 years almost.
Yeah, and I probably should have pushed it into television, but I didn't because I kept, you know, I was a movie guy, even though I had some television experience.
Of course.
I kept pushing movies. But then, you know, some directors don't want you, once you've been a director, they don't want a designer director around.
They're a bit threatened by it, of course.
Yeah, they just don't feel comfortable. And so then, you know, then I really had to start pushing to get design jobs, you know, write letters. I got some nice return letters from Richard Attenborough and Milos Forman and a lot of the European guys, you know.
Yeah.
And Oliver Stone, you know, I was going to co-direct a movie with Oliver Stone called Conan.
No, you're kidding.
No, in fact, it's in his book. Somebody told me. Years before, when I was after Jaws 2, I was going to direct Conan. Oliver wrote it. And the producer didn't feel comfortable with him directing because he was a little bit of a nutcase.
He was had a bit of a problem with some white powder, didn't he?
Yeah, a lot of that. And so Oliver came in, and the director, the producer said, well, we had some other project that we were going to do that I was going to direct called It Came by Night, and that money fell out. And so when he got the rights to Conan, he thought he'd put me with Oliver, and we had a couple of meetings, and so I was going to work with Oliver. He's going to write, and we're going to co-direct the thing. And then Oliver came in one day, he said, I don't want to do this. I'm going to go to the South and write a script about the South. So you direct it, Joe. I said, okay, so that's the way it was. Then De Laurentiis ended up taking hold of the project.
Right.
And then got John Milius to direct it, and that was the end of Joe.
But let's, if you don't mind, let's go back to a bit to the film that did get made. That was Jaws 3.
Yeah.
Because that was a big film.
What happened with Jaws 3 is I was doing this movie called The Ninja for Zanuck and Brown, and I was back in New York, and it was great. I did some scouting there, but I was living there. I had rented an apartment, and as I said, we scouted Japan. We did this stuff. Irv Kershner was a little bit of a nutcase, but nice enough guy. But he couldn't lock the movie down, you know, to cast it. And it was a number one bestseller. The book was eventually. Let's see, I started that in the early part of the year. This was 1980, I guess, and then they just canceled it. So I came in to town, late 80, yeah. And Verna Field, I went to see Verna, see how she was doing. She's, you know, she's the editor of Jaws, and now Verna was executive vice president. And she said, boy, did you see what they're doing with Jaws 3? I said, no. She said, well, Zanuck and Brown didn't want it to do a third sequel, and the studio didn't have much confidence in the a three because there hadn't been many threes made. I don't think there was even a Rocky three yet. So they were going to do this thing, Jaws 3, People Zero, and it was a spoof on the making of Jaws.
Oh, no.
I said, that's disgusting. One of their most successful movies, and they're going to make fun of the making of it?
You're kidding.
You know, like, oh, the shark's not working, the director didn't know what he was doing, this and that. I said, that's absolutely insane.
That's an actual project that was being worked on?
Yeah, Jaws 3, People Zero.
Oh, my God.
It was, I think I read parts of it, and it was terrible. And then I guess it dawned on the executives how stupid they were. They were actually going to make fun of themselves and this movie that was a big success and do like a Mad Magazine, you know.
This is the worst idea ever.
Yeah. So they canceled that, and anyway, there was a script. Richard Matheson, who is a very, very good writer, wrote the book Incredible Shrinking Man and wrote the scripts to Twilight Zone, the movie and stuff. They they sort of sold the rights to a television producer who was did real cheap kind of television, Alan Landsberg. And she said, why don't you go to Alan and see if you could salvage this project? And I said, well, I don't know if I want to do another Jaws. I mean, I've spent my life doing, you know, Jaws 1 and 2. She said, well, go talk to him. So I went to talk to Alan, and he's a guy like to dictate everything, you know. So he said, well, so what do you want to do? I'll let you produce it. I said, well, I've already done that. If I'm going to do anything, I'd like to direct it. He says, all right. He says, I'll tell you what. He says, why don't you work with Richard, work on the script and scout, do whatever you want. Get started, and then we'll decide what's going to happen. So I started in a no-commitment capacity working with Richard, and the script was about a theme park, and the shark comes into a theme park, like right. A Sea World, and so we started scouting sea parks, and Richard and I just sort of walked around these sea parks, and Alan had some very, you know, some crazy ideas about his people that he wanted in the movie, and this and that, and certain things were sort of set. He wanted Dennis Quaid, no matter what, because he had used Dennis in something, okay, I remember we're at a theme park, and they had this exhibit, underwater 3D exhibit. So we walked in there, and I looked at this underwater, going through these caverns, it's underwater in 3D. And I came out, and I said, Richard, I said, Jaws 3D? He said, but Jaws in 3D? I said, no, Jaws 3D, it really takes the onus off of the 3.
Uh-huh.
It makes Jaws in 3D. It's a gimmick, basically.
So that was your idea?
Yeah,
that's
that
amazing.
Was my idea. So, and it wasn't. It didn't seem like such a innovative thing because I'd seen this thing in Jaws 3 and 3D. Okay, well, I didn't realize what I was getting myself into.
You got into some trouble, didn't you?
Yeah. So I think it was around the time of a Thanksgiving or a holiday, and I was at my sister's place up at the lake, and I made this sketch of a shark, and then I had 3D just coming out of the mouth, you know.
Yeah.
So I took it to Landsberg when I got back, and this is good, let's go to Universal. So I went to Universal, showed it to Sid Sheinberg, who was the president of Universal, and he said, well, yeah, can I have this? I'd like to take it to Lou Wasserman, who was head of, you know, MCA. And I says, you can have anything. You know, you own the studio. So they suddenly, Universal realized they had now something they could sell. And now they were sorry that they got rid of the full rights to Jaws 3. So they had this television guy to deal with. They still owned part of it, but they didn't own 100% of it. So he said, after I came up with this idea, okay, you can direct it. All right. But now he, you know, he's used to working with, you know, television directors and telling them what to do and doing these really cheap shows. So I said, okay, well, you know, we have to build a shark. He said, why? I said, because it's Jaws. We need to build a shark. He said, no. I have all this footage, and that's incredible, was a television show he had. So he had, I have all the stock footage of sharks, and we're going to make, like, mechanical people and real sharks, and we'll put the, you know, I said, I don't think so. You know, first of all, we need, it's got to be a white shark. It's got to have some continuity with the other movies. And mechanical people, you know, you wind them up, and they, no, I don't think so. So, yeah, all right. So, and he did really dumb things. Like, he didn't buy the rights to John Williams' music. So we couldn't use da-dum, da-dum. We had to use something very similar, but we couldn't use John Williams. Then I found out there really was no new 3D equipment. You know, I'd Born a Devil and movies like that in the 50s. That's the cameras they had. And so he said, well, you got to start shooting in October. I said, we don't have a camera. He said, well, you got to shoot. I said, well, you don't understand. If you're going to start a movie and you don't have a camera, it's not a movie. And so we got Aeroflex to make us a camera, but in the meantime, he said, you got to start shooting. So we used this thing. Camera department started calling it the Ultra Jam because it kept jamming up. And I had 3D experts that said, oh, you can't pan, you can't do this, you can't do that. I said, well, can't die. You know, it was just incredible. So we shot a week.
Oh, my God.
And that thing was just terrible. So then we got the new camera, and it wasn't compatible with the old camera, the film, the 3D. So we had to reshoot everything. So it was just, I wanted to kill the guy. I really had dreams of just having a gun and walking to his office and blowing his head up. And I thought, okay, what's going to happen to me? I'll go to prison, but I will have the satisfaction of having killed him.
You were actually weighing the options.
I really did. I don't know if I'd go through, but I really, really hated this man. And it was one of the most miserable times in my life trying to direct a movie with this guy. He would come in, and he started telling me shots. And finally, I got an assistant director, Scotty, who was on Jaws 2. And Scotty is about 6'4", 300 pounds or something. Big guy. So when Alan would come on location, I'd have Scotty meet him. And he would just say, Joe's busy right now. Mm-hmm. You know, and just stand there. And
that worked?
It worked. Oh, you know, it was just a lot of things. So I ended up cutting the movie to about, I think, an hour and 58 minutes. A little bit less, you know. So they decided the movie was going to be a big success. So if they had five screenings a day instead of four, if the movie was cut down to an hour and a half. So they just arbitrarily cut the movie. And so I was criticized a lot for expediting the film, you know, or kind of too tight, some of the critics said, you know, and blah, blah, blah.
I think it's better than the second one.
Really?
Yeah, I think it works much better. The second one feels like sort of a rehash of the first one, I mean, because it's the same location. I mean, when you shift location, it sort of feels like a new story. I think it works. It actually works.
Well, I still get a lot of mail from it, from young people. And, of course, if you could have seen it in 3D with glasses, which you probably didn't.
No, it's not. I don't think it's available right now in 3D.
No, and let me tell you what else, David. When I shot it, we used, from a technical standpoint, we didn't use two cameras. It was one camera, and we split a 35mm film in half horizontally, okay? So you have the upper half of the aperture is left eye, and the lower one is right eye. So you end up with this incredible wide screen proportion. Do you understand?
Yeah.
So it's half of 35 cut in half.
Right.
So the screen is very wide. When they released it in DVD, they didn't scan it. They just chopped out a third of the movie. So you'll have a scene where I have four actors, and you'll see four of them talking, but you only see two people. It was really widescreen because that's the way we had to do the 3D. So not for, you know, it didn't destroy a lot of things, but there are a lot of scenes where I had a bigger scope, and they just clipped off the ends. I think in some respects I wasn't too unhappy. The cast wasn't bad. Lou Gossett was good, and
the cast is really good. I mean, you have Leah Thompson in I think one of her first roles in the film, and she's really cute. And Dennis Quaid is really likable, so it works. I think it works.
I know. You know, I Leah, it was funny because nobody wanted her, and so she came in Hollywood, and I liked her, and my. Casting director, Sherry Rhodes, is the same one on Jaws 1, 2, and Close Encounters, an old friend of mine from Sugarland. And so I said, I like her. And she said, well, I know, but nobody else likes her, and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, then we go to New York and cast there. And so Leah just pops in. This is how, you know, she says, well, I knew you wanted to see me again, so I'm just here, you know. Well,
that's great.
You didn't. And I said to Sherry, you know, Sherry, I like her. She's got a lot of spirit, and, you know, you just tell everybody I want her. So they said, okay, if Joe really wants her, hire her. So that's how she got her first role. So it was fun, and then of course she did a thing with Tom Cruise later. She did Back to the Future, and so that worked. Oh, but you know, I have an interesting story that happened. Steven Spielberg's wife, Kate Capshaw. So I ran into Steven 10 years ago or so, at a mall.
He goes to malls?
He goes to malls. I was shocked. I was with my wife. This is the early 90s, and so he's still a big director, right? And I'm walking around, and we're at like a food court or something. And so we're eating there, and Jerry says, there's Spielberg. So, you know, I went up, Steven, you know, we hadn't seen each other talk for a long time. And it was interesting. He was sort of apologetic because he said, oh, yeah, you know, like, he didn't hire me for the Raiders thing. And he, you know, he said something about, you know, I had to hire an English guy and this and that. And I know that's okay, you know, because I had already directed and stuff, but it was just the attitude. Anyway, he said, well, let's sit down and have lunch. So I sit in there and Kate came. She had been somewhere, and my wife, and we're talking, and Kate said, yeah, and you didn't hire me on Jaws 3. And I said, what? She said, well, I interviewed for it. Don't you remember?
Oh, my God.
And I had totally forgot, David.
Oh, my God.
Could you imagine that? I didn't hire Spielberg's wife. Had I known, I would have, right?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, it was just a coincidence. Yeah, I know, you're right. Steven Spielberg goes walking around malls. Hey, you know, in certain parts of Hollywood, you could do that, you know. And that was Jaws 3. And it didn't make a lot of money. The pictures...
It did okay. It did okay, yeah.
Oh, yeah. For example... Now they release 2,000-4,000 screens when they open the movie. I think it was released 1,200. We made it for $16 million. It made $45 million in 2 weeks. I talked to Landsberg some years later. I ran into him at a school where my kids were, and he said, I made over $100 million, you know. So it was a big success, but it didn't help me much, directing-wise.
It had it has a bad reputation, very unfairly.
Well, first of all, the critics hated sequels then. It's not like today. Today, they do Pirates of the Caribbean 1, and then they make 2 and 3 at the same time.
Oh, they can't get enough of this these days.
Yeah, yeah. So you can't get enough of a sequel. If it's a good thing, you know, Iron Man, I'm sure they're making Iron Man 2 already.
Oh, yeah, it's 2010. It only has a release date.
But back then, if you made a sequel, these critics were all over you. But I must say this. I did Jaws 1, 2, and 3, and they all made tons of money. Jaws 4 disappeared. it lost money immediately.
And it had Michael Caine in it.
Had Michael Caine and a good director, Joe Sargent. I think it was saturated. I think they reached the point of saturation.
But I like the third one because it's the SeaWorld thing. It's very, I mean, to get a shark into that environment, it seems really creepy, and it worked very well with visuals.
And it's a possible thing that a white shark could get into a theme park.
Absolutely, yeah.
But, you know, critics are all over me. Like, for an example, I'll never forget this. I was doing a scene with all the skiers towed together. So I wanted, you know, the one skier to get attacked, and she falls. The technical advisor said, well, if she falls, they all fall. I said, why is that? She said, because they're all tied together. If they don't all fall, then you've got somebody you're dragging underwater while the other ones are skiing. And I said, oh, well, that's interesting. I said, well, that's sort of good. So they attack her, and then they all fall, and it's a panic. I said, okay. So that's what we did. Well, here comes this critic. How silly. How stupid. Why would they all fall if one person falls, you know? Now, critics don't bother to research anything. They just criticize, right?
Yeah.
So he made a big thing out of how stupid that was, you know. Of course, had he called somebody Ski World, they would have told him that that was the way. But, you know, when you make a movie, you're subject to this stuff.
And you certainly was on that film. It took a lot of heat.
Yeah, a lot of heat, and so it was really really hard. Getting another directing thing, and
Because you never did direct a feature film after that, did you? I mean, a full length film.
No, I just directed the second unit stuff. Yeah. Starman directed some second unit of Free Jack, and then a couple of movies that I started as a director, and then the financing ran out, and that's it. But you know, if somebody came to me and same thing with designing, if it was a really interesting project with some people I knew and I liked. But, you know, other than that, I'm not that excited about it. I had a good long career, you know.
Absolutely. But are you still doing any production design?
No, I pretty well stopped. After I did two animated movies, one after 2 years, they ran out of money. But I spent 4 years doing these computer 3D animated movies, and I enjoyed them. A lot, and it was sort of good because I now had kids, and I was able to stay in town and have a more normal life. Where the other times, you know, you're away for 5, 6, 7 months or a year, and this was good. I was in town, except on the Indian one. I made three trips to India, which was okay, and I was gone maybe for a month or 2 months at a time, and that was a good experience.
This is one called Sinbad and the Veil of Mist, right?
Yeah, and it ended up because it just the technology wasn't there, and the animators from India weren't that good. It ends up looking like a video game, you know, I mean, a computer game kind of thing.
It looks a bit strange, but I think it's the first film that did that motion capture thing.
Yeah, we did motion capture. But this is a thing, you know, I could talk, do another class on the thought process of making films and how it affects, how the same process goes into doing a computer animated movie. When I was building these sets, I was in India and I was building these sets in 3D, and we were putting motion capture people, cartoon characters, animated characters in the sets. This was in 98. And my thoughts were, gee, you know, we could put real people in these. Right. And I could build just a fraction of the sets, just the stuff that they integrate, you know, they walk in front of or have contact with. And the rest could be computer generated. And
here we are 10 years later, and that's exactly what people are doing right now.
Yeah, and I realized that. So I was fortunate enough to see the transition and to work on the transition. And I still approached my art department in the same way. I found that I still had set designers that drew on paper with the triangle and T-square and stuff. And I had model makers make the the characters out of clay first, and we did all this process. I really found after some experiments, the best process was to do it, and Lucas worked this way too, to do the thing as I would design a live-action movie, you know, same process, draw the plans, elevations, then I go to the computer people. Same thing as I would go to my painters with paint samples, or my, you know, plaster people with textures. And I would go to the computer people and I'd say, okay, I want the bricks to look like this, but they're wet and they've got mildew and moss and stuff, and so they should have this kind of texture. And so then they would give me texture samples. So it really related very, very similar to do live action, except it was all on the computer. Now, I don't know if a lot of people do that because maybe they don't have the same background, but I felt that it was very successful working in that way. You know, so even though things are done differently, the thought process doesn't have to be.
Would you still build you know, models of the sets?
Oh, yeah.
Because you mentioned you've done that on almost all your films, right?
Yeah, even on the computer animated movies, we built models before it went into the computer. Yes, I know you could do it in the computer, but it allowed us to sit around a table and look at a model instead of everybody sort of staring at a screen, you know.
Yeah.
And it gave us what the characters and other stuff, a dimensional thing to look at. Then it was a lot easier to interpret for the computer people. There wasn't as much question as, you know, what we're going to do.
Have you used the computer then on some of your live action films?
No, because I stopped doing live action films pretty much before the computer was used a lot.
Oh, I see.
Now, we talked about it, you know, on Close Encounters. In fact, there was one guy that Colin Cantwell that Lucas put on us. Lucas says, "Oh, you got to use this guy." So he kept hanging around, bugging me throughout most of making a movie that he could do the whole thing in the computer. Well, yeah, but he was about 20 years too soon. After much laboring, you know, hours and hours to get one image, his head was in the right place, but he wasn't. It wasn't there yet. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and Josh Lucas obviously had ideas for what would be the future for him.
Yeah. And so he was talking to Steven, and we went to some people that had some things. But I mean, it took 72 hours to produce one still image, and so it just wasn't practical at that time. And Trumbull was developing stuff, but he, as far as computer stuff, all they were using the computer was to record like motion control, you know. And then when I did the motion capture thing, that was sort of interesting in both Sinbad, and the other movie was called PC and the Web, and it was a really interesting concept. And it was PC was Peter Collins, and his little boy that gets sucked into a computer, and he's on the information highway. So it was really like the Wizard of Oz, and so I made this highway, and he runs into Yahoo, who's a surfer that lost his nerve. So I had him surfing on the highway. He runs into a virus, and she has all these worms that were attacking them, you know. And then they fall into Amazon, which was really the whole big forest, but it was all books, you know. If you look at it real close, the bark of the tree were books, the river was books. So, I mean, I did a lot of it. I spent 2 years on that thing.
Oh, my God, this sounds funny.
Oh, it was funny. It was really brilliant, and I thought we were really going to have something. And director Chris Kane, who hadn't really done anything in there, he did Young Guns, a couple of small movies, but he got these finance people together, and he wrote the script, and I thought it was great. And he said, "We're going to do this different. We're not going to do it like Pixar and have all these committees. You know, you're going to be the designer. I'm going to be the director. We'll make these decisions." Well, he did exactly the opposite. And the thing just went on forever and ever. And the financing just dropped out, you know.
Again, the financing.
Yeah. And I was really sad because I thought, it. You know, we went to the Oracle. I mean, it was really a play on Wizard of Oz in the computer land, you
right,
know.
Right, right.
And if he could have gotten the connections with Yahoo to use a name as one character, and Amazon, and you know, I think he was trying to get a thing with Dell Computers, and we were using some of the state of the art at the time. But then he got too many people involved and too many different opinions, and then I had made the whole movie actually. I had an editor, a girl that was really good, and we had the advent, the first time that I worked on the computer animated system. And I had some really great illustrators, and we did like 3,000 storyboards, and many of them in color. And so we scanned them all in, and the director was sort of doing something else, so I worked with her, and I did a pre-viz of the whole hour and a half of the movie in storyboards.
Oh, my God.
And it looked really great. I wish I had a copy of it, because I could use it for her.
You got very far in the process, then.
Oh, yeah, and I loved it, because I could work with her, and then... you know, we needed a little thing, a section with our virus, and I used to be an animator. I started at Disney's as an animator, you know, and so I did paper animation. So I'd go back to my office, and I'd get a light board, and I'd animate a little sequence, and we'd scan that in, and you'd get movement, you know, and we'd add as we added color, you know, from their pencil sketches to color sketches, we would scan those in. So we had a really good pre-visualization of the whole movie with a temp track and everything, and it was a lot of fun they just came in one day and said they're closing shop.
That's unfortunate. That's really unfortunate.
Yeah.
But how do you feel about the way that the whole film industry is moving towards now, where computers are really taking over? But like you mentioned now, people aren't drawing anymore. They're just building the sets in the computer. The computer, the designs never leave the computer at any point. They shoot at entirely green screen, and then they just shoot the actors. And
I know, said like Robert Rodriguez in the Sin City, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, I think it works for some projects. I mean, I enjoyed Sin City. From what I understand, people that I, you know, friends of mine that work in CGI, they say it could be easier, but it's not. They make the movie and then they remake the movie. They don't do as much planning. They just know they can fix it in the computer.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much control the production designer has over the CG, if he designs the whole set or they have some computer guy design the set. But the way I would look at it is I would treat it, if I was in a movie, just like I would design the whole set. I would illustrate the thing, the whole thing, and then I would work with the director and see how much we had to build. I mean, if we had a castle, and we had this big castle, and how much, and there's going to be a sword fight or something, well, maybe we just need to build 10-foot walls where they do the sword play, and that might be better than doing it in green screen.
Right.
You know, and then you green screen above that. I mean, or you computer do the CGI above that. doing the whole thing in green screen, I think is bad for the actors.
Yeah,
they've got no interplay.
You can sort of tell they're not there, right? I mean, in their eyes. Sometimes.
Yeah, they're not there. They have no eye line. They're not relating to. You know, I used to try to walk the actors through the sets, and so they have a feeling about things. You know, I've had actors come to me and say, "Do you mind if I?" Kerry Gar on Close Encounters said, "You know, once a Steven said, you know, I want to talk to Joe about some stuff and set dressing." And he came to me, "Do you mind?" I said, "Fine. I like Terry. In fact, we went out a couple times. Nice lady." And basically, she wanted to add some turtles. The character collected little ceramic turtles or something. And I said, "That's great. Whatever, you know." But it's important to me that the actor has an environment that they feel comfortable. It looks like, you know, they belong there.
Yeah, because you lose something, don't you? I mean, for example, if you're on a green screen scene, you couldn't have done that with Terry Guy. You couldn't have walked her through and say, "Oh, no, you need this." I mean, you lose something.
Yeah, of course you do. So that's why I think it's you still build the sets, because it's not all that cheap doing everything in the computer. That costs money.
No, it's not. It costs a lot of money.
Yeah. So my feeling is you build what you relate to and you interact with, and then you put on top of that the CGI, and because you do it in CGI, you don't go crazy. I mean, this is another thing. I think they build things that are just so out of proportion. It's so huge and so ridiculous because it's CGI now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so if it's a castle, it's you know, it's not just a little castle. It's got to be the biggest castle ever built, you know.
It's funny. So sometimes these days you can tell it's computer effects, not because you can see it visually, because you say, well, there's no way that could exist in real world.
Yeah, it's out of the proportion. And what you just said is right. There's no way that could exist in the real world, so it takes you out of the reality of it. But and if you're doing, you know, Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Okay, it got pretty carried away, but it's such a fantasy, you know that it's another world, right?
Yeah.
So you buy it. Yeah, so you can get away with it on that. But I think Lucas sort of went over the top on some of his later ones. Yeah, I mean, I think there's something about a density in the film frame. He just had no negative space. There was always something, too many things happening. And sometimes your eye just wants a negative space.
Right.
And that's another thing I talk to students about, you know. Positive and negative space is very important, I think, in a scene. And there's times you want a lot of, you know, just positive, you know, a lot of things happening. But there's times the negative space and one character looking out to nothing, you know, serene or whatever. It works. And I think George has got so dense with so many things happening, so many things flying, and so many, you know, an army of, you know, God, 2 million. And it was just... It was like, give my eye a break, you know?
And also, I think you sometimes lose some of those... It seems sometimes that some of the greatest scenes in film history were mistakes. I mean, things that were just caught on camera by mistake. And you lose that as well.
Well, yeah, because you don't allow any accidents to happen, you know?
I mean, for example, take something like Jaws. Would you have, if that was done in a computer, you never would have come up with that idea of the yellow barrels, for example.
No, exactly, and the yellow bar is clearly the tension. Yeah, because, you know, Rennie Harlan had a sort of slick shark movie, and I don't think it shook up the world.
Deep Blue Sea? No, it didn't.
I mean, the sharks look really slick.
They look great, but I'm not as afraid of them.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? So it all gets back to filmmaking. I mean, the barrels created, you know, an atmosphere of, you know, and sometimes it's what you don't see, and you know, and that goes for a lot of things. It goes for sex too. You know, sometimes it could be overly blatant, and more suggestion sometimes is more, you know, exotic. It still comes down to good choices, and I just think today there's so many choices, too many choices, and sometimes when you have too many choices, you know, you just do it because you can do it. And I got to tell you, I enjoy some of the small films I get from the Academy, small European films, you know. So I think I gravitate to some of these small movies more because it's personal and they're not, you know. And I think that's the whole key. You got to care about the people. I don't care if it's a shark or spaceship, you know.
And on that note, with those wise words, we end our somewhat long interview with production designer Joe Alves.
But not a second too long.
Exactly.
I'd like to add, not a second too long.
He's really an interesting man to listen to.
Yeah, he's got a lot of great stories.
Yeah, exactly. I wish he would do commentaries for a lot of his films.
Yeah, and he did one, actually, on...
Oh, that's true, yeah
he on did one. Escape from New York, the special edition. He did a commentary on that
with
one.
Yeah, with the producer, Deborah Hill, as I recall.
Yeah, right? And he's also featured in both the documentary on Jaws, the special edition anniversary thing, and on Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the special edition.
So lots of Joe's stuff to check
out. Lots of Joe's stuff.
Yeah, and you should check it out because he's a nice guy.
Yes, he is.
Can't believe you talked to us for that long.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, well, that's it for this special episode of Double D's Definitive DVD Podcast. Log on to our webpage, davidbjerre.dk/podcast. That's... Oh, would you spell it this time?
Oh my
no,
I'm
gonna do it. I'm gonna do it.
We already spelled it.
Yeah, but that's like an hour and 15, 20 minutes ago.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
Spelling in.
davidbjerre.dk/podcast/Joe.
Alrighty then.
That's the URL for this specific interview.
All right.
And of course, you'll be able to click on the menu to the left, and there'll be a little English flag, and you'll click on that, and you'll get some information about us in English. Because usually, as I pointed out earlier, this is a Danish podcast. Yep. So, I think that's about it.
Yes, I think you're right.
All right, we should say our names again.
Do it.
No, you first.
Okay, my name is Dennis Rosenfeld, and you are...
David Bjerre.
All right.
And that's it for this interview, and thanks a lot for listening in.
Yeah, have a nice day.